We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we will take up a topic we have certainly talked about before on this program, but maybe here this morning we'll do it in a slightly different way. We'll talk about globalization, and when I use that word, I'm sure that what people think of, first of all, they think about the global economy and economic forces that work globally. Perhaps they also think about global economic entities, organizations, things like the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization and the World Bank, things on that scale. In this hour, we'll be talking with Saskia Sassen. She's a sociologist and well-known internationally as a sociologist who has studied globalization. So maybe that'll tell you that we're going to approach it in a slightly different way. She is interested in economics, but in a slightly different way than, say, an economist would do. Because she's particularly interested in things that are going on, perhaps not so much between nations, as things that are going on within nations, but that are connected in a global sort of a way. Now, we'll try and make that a little bit more clear as we talk in this first hour. Saskia Sassen is the Robert Lind Professor of Sociology at Columbia University. She has authored a number of books. Her most recent, Territory, Authority, Rights from Medieval to Global Assemblages, that was published by Princeton University Press in 2008. Another book, A Sociology of Globalization, published in 2007. Her works have been translated into a number of languages. She's received many honors and awards for her work. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a member of the National Academy of Sciences panel on cities. She has written for a number of publications, including The Guardian, New York Times, Le Monde, Newsweek International, and others. She's visiting the campus. We're pleased to have her here in the studio with us. She's visiting and will be giving a talk this afternoon at 2 on the campus at the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences. She's here sponsored both by the folks in sociology and also the European Union Center. So questions are welcome as we move through the hour, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. If you'd like to send along an email, you can do that too. The address is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
It's a great pleasure, David.
Just, again, I guess as a good way to start would be, again, with that observation, and I know that you, many times when people have conversations with you, I'm sure they start out at this point. They say, okay, when you say globalization, people say, oh, okay, I know what you mean, globalization. And we've been talking about that fairly intensely for, you know, some time now. And it's all about economic forces, the way capital moves, big institutions like IMF and World Trade Organization and so forth. And you say, well, sure, yeah, that's globalization. But that you, what you're interested in, though, is something else. So then the question comes, okay, what is it? What's this other kind of globalization?
Well, I think we have put so much emphasis on things like the International Monetary Fund, the WTO, Global Finance and Electronic Networks. I look at those two. My question is, since most of what happens, certainly the most complex organizational forms, etc., are happening inside the national, we need to see whether what we call the global also gets constituted inside the national. Now, that creates an immediate problem, because a lot of what I think, now after 30 years of doing this, is part of the global, but happens and gets shaped inside the national, is dressed in the clothing of the national. Mm-hmm. So it's, you have to sort of decipher, you know, you have to discover, detect where that global is and how it is. And I find it also inside the executive branch of government, not inside the legislature. But anyhow, in the most formal settings, in the most national settings, I detect instances of the global, and it is that then which I think means that globalization is a significant force. It is significant precisely because to a very large extent it happens inside the national. Mm. It also means that national borders can continue to be as they are. National states will be national states. And so the change, the revolutionary change, happens, I think, in a lot of micro processes that we need to detect. We need anthropologists, we need ethnologists, you know. It is a new epoch, but it is partial. And to a very large extent, it's not immediately visible.
Yeah. So when people think about global economic globalization, they think about the fact that there are powerful economic interests that may be based in particular countries that form a kind of a network in the sense that they're all pursuing the same goal. That doesn't necessarily mean that they know each other or that they ever sit down in one room together, but it constitutes a kind of a network because they're all about the same thing. It sounds to me like what you're saying is that you can also look at other kinds, if network's an okay word to use, other kinds of networks that are made up of people, groups of people within particular countries that have common goals that also in a way form a kind of a global network, even though, like the economic one, they may not necessarily know each other, they may never have met, and they're never all going to get together in one room at one point.
Right, exactly. No, you put it very, very well. And so let me just illustrate, since you already gave us the conceptual description, I might as well illustrate.
Yes, please. Make it a little more concrete for us.
For instance, let me just give you, I want to give you two examples. Yeah. One is about the so-called global firm, which doesn't exist legally speaking. And the other one is about activists who are not cosmopolitan, who are obsessed working in a small town or in a big city, but about a particular issue, you know, that factory that is polluting their water, that torturer in their jail. Not global, but in fact become, like you described, de facto a global process because it's happening in so many places around the world. So the global firm, there is no such legal persona as the global firm. Not even the European Union, which is well positioned to produce a European firm, has succeeded. There is no such thing as a European legal entity that we can call a European firm. We know that there are 350,000 plus firms that conduct themselves as if they were global. So how do you close the gap, right? And the gap is closed in a very specific way. And that is that country after country, all the countries that are members of the WTO for starters, we're talking most countries, though it must be said the number of countries keeps growing. You know, every time you close your eyes, there is a new country. But anyhow, country after country has implemented little deregulations, new regulations, little ordinances, little, you know, low-level bills, often executive power sort of enablements, you know, etc. The executive branch of government, whether prime-ministerial or presidential, plays a big role in all of this. They each use their own national instruments, their national law, national government, etc., to implement standards that allow these global firms to have fairly, you know, similar rights and protections across countries. Now, what is interesting is a combination of the particularities and the differences of the way each state does that. Mm. And the result, however, is a fairly standardized operational space that is a very partial event in each of the global cities or each of the countries where it operates. So it is this extraordinary combination of national specifics and a global standardized space. What I do in my research, I want to recover the national specifics. I don't want to just look at that standardized space. I also look at that, by the way, because that's for real.
Yeah.
But it is made through different, very different national instruments. Now, when you look at the activists, so they are not on email necessarily. They don't speak English, by the way, not all of them, you know. They are obsessed. They are not cosmopolitan. But they constitute a kind of horizontal globality, which is multi-sited. And the one thing about this current epoch, and it goes back really 20 years, is an awareness of a global subjectivity. So they enter some space, and again, they don't need to be on online. In many poor countries, they are not online. Yet they know, I have talked with these people, they know that they are not alone doing this. Yeah. And that is a significant. And then when you have Amnesty International, Oxfam, they can gather all these particular energies and do something with it. But I think Amnesty International, Oxfam, what would they be if they didn't have on the ground these non-cosmopolitan types, who are also producing a globality, however.
Well, this is I think this is really interesting. Here I think is one of the, in the two areas that you talked about, environmental issues, human rights, are probably the easiest things to point to as examples of what it is we're talking about. And also, I think, and as you talk about this, when you look at particular groups in particular places, that, you know, their ability to affect change in their backyard is sometimes pretty limited. But I think you can't, as you have said, you can't quite underestimate the power that comes with the notion that whether I know them or not, or whether I can talk to them or not, there are other people and other countries that are involved in the same struggle that we are here.
Exactly. That is so important. And of course, what happened, you know, the Arab Spring is a very powerful. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues for me is I ask myself often, when does powerlessness become complex? In other words, I stop before empowerment comes about. I love empowerment, but empowerment is pretty rare. Mm-hmm. But I still believe there is some intermediate zone between powerlessness and empowerment, where the actors do not necessarily get empowered right away. It may be the next generation that gets empowered, like with our civil rights movement, which took many generations, right? But that a combination of elements makes their powerlessness complex, and in that complexity then lies the possibility of making a history, of making a politics. And we have seen that over and over. Labor unions, you know, starting in the late 1800s and the 1900s, it took generations sometimes, you know, to really have a strong. And if you had taken only one generation or one point in time, you would have said they're going nowhere, they're powerless, nothing happens. And I think we're seeing that in the Arab Spring as well, especially, of course, in Egypt and in Tunisia. Very interesting stuff. So I think that, and I'm sure that for the Tahrir people, knowing that the world was with him, and Al Jazeera played a far more crucial role in this than Facebook. I must say, I got very irritated. I was in Morocco, you know, and the notion that Facebook was, it was all kinds of other things coming together, including older genealogies of protest, you know, that woke up. There they were, back protesting, you know, the older people.
Our guest in this hour is Saskia Sassen. She's a professor of sociology at Columbia University, where she is also co-chair of the Committee on Global Thought. And she's interested in globalization and approaches that as a sociologist, has done a lot of writing on issues like globalization. She's also interested in the city as both a product of an agent of globalization now. And she's here visiting the campus, and we'll be giving a talk later this afternoon. And anybody who's interested can stop by. Of course, if you want to join this conversation, you can do that too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Talking just again for a second about the economic globalization that we're sort of more used to talking about. The big economists of the past, guys like Adam Smith, they had this idea, they thought about, when they thought about globalization, they thought about the fact that stuff, goods, can move around and were going to move around and would. The thing that they didn't see that has been the big game changer as far as the global economy is concerned is that not only do goods move around, capital moves around and labor moves around. They didn't see that. So that's the things, real big things that have changed things on a global scale. So can you, though, apply to do somehow that expansion of movement, does that also play a role in the kind of globalization that you're interested in?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. My first book actually was called The Mobility of Labor and Capital. I didn't just say The Mobility of Capital, sort of a classic title. I brought in labor first. Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in that. And, I mean, the issue is that migrations have always existed. But like you well say, you know, the classical political economy managed to overlook some of that, not all of it. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, we still have not well integrated the mobility of labor, whether it's immigrants or professionals, into standard models. Maybe standard models will be able to eventually make those issues endogenous to those models. But right now, they're still seen as epiphenomenal. Now, sociologists, that's a different story, but sociologists or anthropologists will just tend to focus on the mobility of labor question, which they often call immigration. Mm-hmm. And so the issue is, how do you make that mobility of labor a critical element of the explanation of an outcome? That is where we are not well positioned. I think that a lot of when economists talk, they very often are actually talking about business. They are not talking about economy. Economy is a far more complex category than business. I found myself in, this is a line that I have repeated now like 150 times, just last year alone. So I'm in these, and it's supposed to be on the economy, what's happening with our economy, etc. And they keep talking about business. Now, business is a critical part, clearly. But economy, you bring in the unemployed, you bring in the underemployed, you just have to bring in all kinds of other things. And so I think that we are really struggling right now. I mean, there are people like Joseph Stiglitz who are working extremely hard, to bring in those other dimensions. But today, I mean, the question of the mobility of people is a much larger category than the mobility of labor. We are, with some of the issues that are happening, I'm going to talk about that this afternoon, land grabs. When China goes and buys 3 million hectares in Congo just to grow palm fuel for biofuel, it expels whole floras, whole faunas, hundreds of villages, and hundreds of smallholder agriculture sort of zones, because it all becomes a plantation. Now, this is a story that is repeating itself. When Coca-Cola used to need 19 liters of water to produce 1 liter of water. They have now become environmentally sustainable, so it takes them only 9 liters of water to produce. They have exhausted whole water tables, then like underground water tables, and then there are cave-ins. People are exposed. The drying up, the imbalance. So what we have are vast mobilities of people that are in some in-between zone that no model allows us to really capture these kinds of things. So we really have to expand the whole notion of the mobility of people, because there's a lot of forced migration that is environmentally driven, that is, economically driven, etc. So there is a lot of work to be done to begin to factor in these trends. We tend to see it in totally separate domains. So we look at these desperate people who have nowhere to go. We do not look at land grabs. When we look at land grabs, we're not really looking at all those people that are expelled from that land. And this is becoming, I think, an acute issue, actually. Yeah. It is truly one of the big issues, because the story has just begun. Between 2006 and 2008, 30 million hectares of land were bought by foreign firms or by foreign governments in various, countries. And now, just a few years later, it's 145 million hectares. That is more than the whole agricultural surface, not of the U.S., but of Europe. So this is a very short history that has just begun. It's acute. And we are not really factoring in where we're going, not to mention food. Suddenly we have entered a period, food scarcities, etc. Mm-hmm. So when you say mobility of people or of labor, I cannot but think of this current phase that has just begun. I'm talking about a history that is now 4 years old in its acute version. Yeah. That's a very new history.
Well, this, and again, when people think about, when people hear the term immigration, I suppose they think about people going from one country to another country. Yeah. But if you look at the demographic movement that you're talking about, and another big demographic trend I think people are paying more and more attention to are people, for a variety of reasons, moving from the rural to the urban. Right. So that's why it is exactly. We have the kind of cities that we have now.
Right.
That's all movement within countries. But yeah. What you're saying is, well, that you can look at that as a global phenomenon.
A multi-sited global phenomenon, though those people themselves don't realize that they're part of a massive global event that is taking place because it's happening in so many parts of the world.
Well, I know yet another thing that you're interested in. I know that you're interested in information technology.
Yeah, very.
And you talked earlier about the fact that you may see these movements that are going on at different places that are part of some sort of larger thing, even if those people aren't connected. And you've talked about the fact, well, not everybody's not online. Well, no, everybody's not. But as time goes along, it's getting easier to get online in some way, and more people are. So do you see information technology playing an important role in bringing people together that previously would have had no way to be in contact with one another?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I really think that there are these new geographies, they are in electronic space, but they are transversal. They cut across. They bring together people. It often is around very specific issues. So they are not necessarily cosmopolitan. They may be very worthy, like anti-trafficking networks. They crisscross the world. These people are absolutely global, but they are concerned with one issue, which is to protect women and children from traffickers, right? And to document. So you have this strange globality. You have multiple globalities. I mean, you have the Islam has multiple global networks. But many of these, I want to emphasize, and also some very worthy ones, like what I was saying about the environment, they're actually like, I call them provincial globalities. They are concerned with particular, they're like global provincialisms. And because I really care about keeping this connection to those who are not thinking themselves as global. There are a lot of people, most people resist that. They feel very uncomfortable and they don't feel that they themselves are. Even though structurally speaking, I argue, they probably, some of them are, for the reasons that we already covered. But what I do also see emerging because of these digital technology, really, interactive domains that are online, is number one, a return of a far greater use of a whole diversity of languages. Mm-hmm. There are enough people, you have crossed a threshold. So you have whole networks that use a language that we thought there were only three people using that language in the world. We discover, there are. So there are many of these other trends that are happening. But I also think that digital space is a variable, the people that use it. So at the one hand, we may be dealing with very narrow issues. At the other end, we're dealing truly with global issues, and you have a whole community. I especially see it in the activists, but it happens in other things as well, that is very alert to all kinds of political movements that are happening, that tries to sort of bring together, make present to the world little initiatives. This is becoming very important. I now have a project that I call the Global City and the Global Slum. The slum is a new word. Huh? It is not simply an objective description of rundown housing. It's being, it's basically the big slums of the global south. Mm-hmm. And some of these slums are actors on a global stage. It doesn't mean that they aren't poor and that there isn't a lot of misery, but there is a self-consciousness. There are enough activists involved with them. There are often sort of lower middle-class people who also live in these slums. Mm-hmm. It's very important to understand. And Dharavi, Kibera, Rosinha, these are global slums. And so in that sense, the most disadvantaged also get sort of this place, at this table that involves some of the most powerful actors, global finance, and then some very... So there is a lot to be... I always feel that anthropologists and sociologists should be making critical contributions to map, if you want, these kinds of globalities that are very elusive. It's very difficult to understand. Whenever you enter the social, it's not like an economic market or a farm or, it is a different story. And it's elusive. You don't know when does the national end or the local end and the global begin. We need new languages almost to capture that. Mm-hmm. And the binaries that we use, global, national, local, cosmopolitan, they hide. They name a lot of stuff. They are good explanations, but they are partial. And the better they are, the more difficult it is for us to see what it is that they obscure. So a term like cosmopolitan says a lot, but in that language also lies an obscuring of all kinds of other forms of globality that are not necessarily cosmopolitan. So that is sort of one of the things that I think of when I think of a sociology of globalization.
Mm. Well, our guest in this hour is Saskia Sassen. She is a sociologist who is interested in globalization and a very well-known, internationally known figure in the field of the sociology of globalization. And as we have explained, she's written a lot. She's written about human migration and its causes. She's written about the importance of place in a globalized society. She's also interested in information technology. She's here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk this afternoon. We have a caller here. We'd certainly welcome anyone to join the conversation, and we hope people can be brief and be on the topic, but certainly you can join us. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have someone on the phone here, and they're in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Thanks, David. Two questions. The first, your guest mentioned the palm forest and its exploitation for fuel.
Yes.
And do you know ADM, who is a huge entity here in the U.S., have purchased some 30,000 acres of, I think, palm forest in Brazil.
Yes.
And if the object is to exploit that for use in the first world, and the resources go out of there, and usually in, under those circumstances, there are few who benefit.
Mm-hmm.
That being the case, and I would like to hear you explain your views about the capitalist paradigm and where it has taken us so far, and if you think that it is going to be sort of Eden for the masses of people on this earth. Thank you, and I'll listen on the radio.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much for the question. And very interesting, that datum that you mentioned, and I'm impressed at the modesty of the acquisition, you know, 30,000 hectares, because the there are millions of hectares that are being bought by a variety of countries and firms. By the way, Goldman Sachs also bought 40,000 hectares of land in Ukraine. So did Goldman Sachs. They're not about to become farmers. This is just a very good investment. But to the point that you raise, I think we have entered a phase in capitalism where we are using up so much of the nature's capital, if you want, which has not been priced in the standard economic models, that you are on the other side of the curve. Self-destruction sets in. We see it already in the United States, where a lot of corn farmers are growing corn for biofuels, right? That has raised the prices of food enormously. So this is, in all settings, this is becoming very, very problematic. And the second point I would like to make, besides the absence of a pricing, a proper pricing of natural resources in terms of how we use them, we only price them for market to sellers. We don't price nature's capital properly. And there is a branch of economics called ecological economics, which is quite complicated, that seeks to do that. But that, in a way, is not even enough, I would say. The second issue is a temporal issue. So a mine sets up an operation or a plantation of palm fuel. They hire laborers. But after 20 years, after 30 years, they have exhausted the soil. And it's dead land. The owners go away, and what they have left behind is dead land. So the people are actually poorer in that region than they were when they started. When you take a longer temporality, you really see, or the same thing with the toxicity of mines. A mine sets up operation, creates jobs. But after 30 years, the water and the soil are very toxic, and the health of the people are destroyed. So we really need to bring in new measures. And then I would say that we can establish that right now we are in a very destructive phase that is basically unsustainable. Mm. And it is not for the good of the people. What looks good year one, they have a laborer's wage. 20 years later, they're deadly ill, and their children are also ill from all the toxicity. I mean, that's a very dramatic way of putting it.
Our guest in this part of Focus, Saskia Sassen, talking with us about the sociology of globalization. We have another caller. We'll talk some more in just a moment. First, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
I'm David Thiel from WILL-TV. Join me this October for a Friends of WILL tour of London, Yorkshire, and Wales. We'll see stately homes and splendid scenery with connections to some of our most popular TV programs. Three-night stays in each of our locales offer us plenty of free time. Call us at 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu for more information.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We're here weekday mornings, and we have 10 different topics every week. Let me just mention that the show that we had scheduled for hour number two, our monthly program on computers, will not be able to do because our guest, Peter Kimball, won't be able to be here. So what we'll do in hour number two is reach into the archives for a show that we originally did in February, and this was a conversation that we had with Evgeny Morozov, author of the book The Net Delusion, The Dark Side of Internet Freedom. There are a lot of people who argue the Internet can be a powerful tool for political activists working to topple authoritarian regimes. But in this book, Morozov says that is much a product of cyber-utopian thinking, thinking that refuses to see that there is a downside of online communication. So if you didn't hear that first time around, you'll have another opportunity. Let me also mention that on the program tomorrow, we'll be talking with Adam Hochschild. He's an award-winning writer. Perhaps people will know him for a book that he wrote about the history of the Congo, King Leopold's Ghost. He has a new book out that is a history of World War I and particularly looks at an aspect of the First World War that I think a lot of people haven't gotten a lot of attention. That is the fact that there were actually people who opposed the war. And so he'll talk with us about that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour.
I want to hear that, too.
Well, you can hear it online.
Yes.
In fact, our past programs are online. If you'd like to catch up on some you may have missed, you can also look at the schedule for next week and the weeks ahead. Go to will.illinois.edu. In this hour, we're talking with Saskia Sassen. She is a professor of sociology at Columbia University. She's the author of a number of books that have to do with things like migration, with the importance of place in a globalized society, of information technology. Her recent books include Territory, Authority, Rights, From Medieval to Global Assemblages. She is here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 2. This is sponsored by the Sociology Department and also the European Union Center on the campus. This is 2 o'clock this afternoon at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, room 126. So if you'd like to hear her, you're invited. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We also have the email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's another caller to talk with, line 1, Champagne. Hello.
Hi, David.
Yes?
You do so well in talking. I hope there are digests of what the guest speakers have to say of the programs. But the mentioning of grand uses of water in order to produce minuscuous amounts of saleable things at high price, and the shifting of whatever you call capital, and if we just change it a little bit to money capital, why is it that our government bailouts of massive monetary industries, banks, and what have you, go about to the trouble of simply allowing oil industries to create super demand for oil products by increasing the amount of military reserves? Why we go to the trouble of taking bank bailout money and not lending it to people for working purposes, but take it and lend it to people for buying vast hectares or acreage, 2.5 acres make a hectare. The business of stealing and giving to a handful of people the wealth of the world in order to give a world free trade zone where we enslave many poor people out of the country, make it not possible to make a modest living in this country, and also demeans things by simply becoming the number one exporter of violence in the world.
Yeah. Well, you have raised a bunch of issues, and from my perspective, you're going in the right direction in interpreting the meaning and the negatives of all of this. Let me just mention one thing about a couple of things that you have said, but the first one is the question of finance, a subject that I've been working on for 30 years. And I just want to point out, it comes back to some of the initial statements, David, that you made. But, you know, when we bailed out the banks, there was a strong sense, starting with Bush and then continuing with Obama, and it was always, of course, the Goldman Sachs crowd hanging in there. There was a strong notion, and you heard a lot of commentary about it, this is the return of the strong national state that participates in the economy to make it a better economy. That really is a misrepresentation. This was the executive branch of government and its sister entities, you know, the central bank, the treasury, etc., using national law to get at national taxpayers' money to rescue a global financial system. This is where we're at. When Angela Merkel, I feel that this is very problematic, by the way, in case I wasn't clear. When Angela Merkel pulls in 700 billion euros from EU, she did the same thing, only via a mix of European and national instruments, using national taxpayers' money gotten at through the national laws in order to set up a fund that is not going to the people of Greece, the people of Portugal, the people of Spain. It goes straight, most of it at least, to pay the banks. For what? So that these governments can make more loans. So we're dealing with logics that are truly perverse and that are clearly not always visible. Because of the law that we passed in Congress, you know, which was a very complicated law, so nobody noticed, a little clause that mandated the Federal Reserve to give us, the citizens, it was our money they took for the bailouts, give us the full information to whom this money went. There were 21,000 transactions. Many, many of those were foreign banks, foreign multinationals, and so-called American firms that had really nothing to do with the bailout, strictly speaking, like General Electric. So we are dealing with a level of corruption, frankly, in our system that happens within the law, because there are blank holes, if you want. This is a very, very serious issue you raise, and I could go on and on, but I won't. You mentioned a whole bunch of other things, oil, etc. I just want to mention one final item that has to do also with finance. Well, finance is the most acute, and it illustrates. Finance is not just about the power it has, which is now like $600 trillion. It's a notional value. It's a value of outstanding derivatives. When you think global GDP is $54 trillion. In other words, the value that finance can mobilize, and we mentioned it in money, but it is not really money, but anyhow, is 14 times the value of global GDP. That is a bit much. You know, finance will always be more than global GDP, certainly in our present, but 14 times? So that already gives you a sense of something. How does finance do that? I like to make a comparison. I always say traditional banking sells money it has. Finance sells money it does not have. And in that not having then lies the brilliance of making the creative classes, making the instruments, etc. But it also means that finance forever needs to enter other economic sectors. So the subprime mortgage is but the last frontier. Actually, the last frontier is taxpayers' money because they have run out, they have financialized just about all sectors of the economy. That means that a financial logic enters economic sectors that are not about finance per se. And when they ran out of that, they went to the taxpayers, and that also worked. What is next? I don't know, but I see the other side of the curve hitting.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this hour. Our guest is Saskia Sassen. She's professor of sociology at Columbia University. We're talking about globalization, the way that sociologists are interested in looking at it. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to come back to something that you have touched on, and I, again, it's something I know that you're interested in, and that is the the future of the nation state, given what we're talking about. And I think that there are some people who have looked at, again, have looked at economic globalization, and they've looked at the rise of big transnational corporations and being very powerful, and they've regional trading blocks, things like the European Union, big organizations like the IMF and World Bank and so forth. And they've said, well, you know, what we can see is a weakening of the power and influence of the nation state. And some people maybe would even say that they'll still be nations and they'll have names and they'll have boundaries, but that somehow they just won't matter as much as they have in the past. And I think you and other people seem to be saying, well, no, that's really not, that's not quite
right.
Their nation states are not going to go away.
Right. So there is a, for me, when I sit there and try to figure out what comes next, given all this stuff that I've documented, which is fairly destructive, frankly, you know, of the whole notion of a national economy, you know, with growing inequality, etc. I see two scenarios. One is truly a bad one. And the other one is full of very attractive potentials. So we have a lot of, as we said, globalities. We have all these national states still in place. These now give me the first, the good one. The national states have learned something about being internationalist. I'm talking about national states. Mm-hmm. Pity that this learning has been focused mostly on finance, you know, and multinational corporations. But they have learned something. So here's my fantasy. My fantasy is made up of two parts. One is with the proper governing classes and a citizenry that takes itself seriously and doesn't simply consume its citizenship and its democracy, we can gear that internationalism towards so many of the urgent issues that we have, which is not protecting big banks, but protecting the environment, addressing global hunger, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Now, in there hangs a possibility of what I think of as denationalized states. Any working state is a more complex capability than the richest multinational corporation, which just has one aim. The state is a structure, it's a capability that can handle multiple contradictory logics and tensions and demands and requirements. It's a strong capability that we cannot lose. But I see a juxtaposition of that kind of state with global regimes. We need global regimes that these denationalized states are in charge of implementing. I do not believe in a global state. And I don't believe, nor do I promote or call for, the end of the national state. What I want is that capability to become denationalized, more internationalist, and to enact and support, it's a fantasy, I know, these new global regimes that we need to protect the environment, to do away with global hunger, etc., etc. The dystopic version is a national state which is really a state, you know, that all that capability is used to protect some of this emergent, really global class of owners and controllers. And that is really going to be bad. And that means that the notion of the nation state ceases to exist. You know, a two-class society with a state that is globally integrated with global elites and other globalizing states that are neoliberal states, and then the rest, you're on your own. More potholes, so to say.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that is a very negative. But I'm hoping for the first one.
Yeah. How, you know, one, it seems to me that particularly, you know, out in the last few decades, starting when the Cold War ended, people started talking more and more about nationalism as a force in, if not global politics, then regional politics. And that I wonder how, and as much as that is powerful, nationalism is powerful in terms of how people identify, it still seems to me that when people identify, they think about who I am, their frame is really narrow.
Yeah.
And how you get people to think of themselves with the kind of globalization that you're sort of advocating for, that is a sort of a globalization of the common good, that it means that people have to think about the common good. And I think there may be actually a natural tendency of people not to think about
run
the common
away from
good.
That.
Exactly.
Run away.
You know, they're thinking about, they're thinking about the good of themselves, their family, their neighbors maybe, their community maybe. But that could be pretty small. So how you nudge people in the direction of thinking about being members of a much bigger community.
Yeah, I have actually thought about this issue because I think it is critical. We cannot expect people to become cosmopolitan globalists. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. I don't think I am one. Mm-hmm. So what comes back to where we started, the possibility that you are not cosmopolitan, you are obsessed with your local issues and problems, and yet an emergent subjectivity that you are not alone, that others around the world are also there. And that is why I believe that the state needs to be a denationalized state, but we need the state. The notion of national borders going on, yes, and that's a whole other subject, you know, how to handle those borders. But I don't think we can, I think it would be a nightmare, frankly, if we all were cosmopolitan globalists. I mean, it's just not there. So what I think is a mix of a denationalized community of states that takes care in both directions, the global commons and the national commons, so to say, and a citizenry that can be totally local. They can be tribal. They can be provincial. They can be obsessed with their local community. But with a kind of an emergent subjectivity that says, you know, I'm just like people in 75 other countries. And Tahrir Square in Egypt made that clear. You know, the Egyptian young and some of the elderly that were there, etc. God, they're a bit like us. Only they had much more courage, frankly, you know. So I think, but in there hangs a discourse, I mentioned it in passing, that citizenship and democracy need to be made. We have all become consumers. You know, and now we're entering a phase where we know, for instance, in the United States, the sons and daughters of the middle class are going to have less income, less education, and less likely to own a home. They have an inheritance of a possibility and an expectation to be better than their parents, better off. So in there lies the possibility of a notion we have to remake our citizenship, we have to remake our democracy. Mm. But this notion of making, I like that word, making. Mm.
Well, that also seems that what's necessary here, if people are going to be happy, is that...
happy,
well, I know.
That's a big one.
If people are going to be... what I'm getting at is the idea is that how we have defined well-being is going to have to change.
Exactly. And I think, some of that consuming is part of, is a function of a kind of isolation, not enough really thick networks, you know. And so when people begin to be serious about the environment, they'll have to collectivize. So there are many forces afoot that are pushing towards an incentive for people to work together. If we are going to be environmentally sustainable in our cities, we're going to wind up working together much more than we can now.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'll try to get them in. We have a couple of minutes left. Let's go to Bloomington, Illinois, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Excellent program. I have one, being a farmer, I have a vested in one of your statements. I read in several what I would consider sources that publicity that food costs were increased due to production of ethanol, the growth of corn, was a PR promoted by the oil industry.
I think many things are coming together. This increase in the food prices that begins, you know, in the last 3 years, we see it very sharply. There are so-called natural conditions, you know, the fires in the Soviet in Russia, not the Soviet Union, in Russia, etc. There is the fuel thing, and there is evidently quite a bit of facts that signal that the oil companies that there is some sort of relationship between the price of ethanol or, you know, biofuels, the price of oil, and the price of food. This is an articulation in the making, but that they will sort of travel together. What is good for one becomes good for the other, and in the end, it's not so good for the rest of us. I hope I've sort of addressed your question. Again, you know, this is a history in the making. This is a very short history. And the more facts we have, you as a farmer, critical actor, you know, in our new world, farmers are critical, especially small farmers, which are the most productive. We know that. Keep on studying the numbers because it is an emergent history.
And this is something I appreciate the call and something that we probably should be. We have talked about some. We probably should talk about some more. And as I think just the basic point to be made is that when you look at the increase in food prices, there's not a single cause. And
that's
I think
right.
That, you know, depending upon what issue you're really concerned about, you might point to one thing and say, well, this is it. I think it's really a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And that it does involve environment. For example, because there are certain places where, for one reason or another, they had real serious problems that affected their ability to produce crops. Floods, fires, drought, you know, the worst kind of weather.
Yes.
You know, so it's not just it's not just a single thing. No. It's a lot of things that have come together all at the same point.
Yeah.
We're almost at the point where you're going to have to finish. I don't know if you can do this in a minute. if we were having this conversation, say, 10 years from now, what is the future of globalization? And will we be talking about something different? Maybe we'll be talking more about the kinds of things we've been talking about this morning.
Did you say 10 years?
I'm thinking, you know, sometime in the reasonably near future, but out some
right.
years.
Right. No, I think that we will have these structurations, if you want, you know, these realities that are both material. They are technical and they're subjective that tend towards the global. I think the world is shrinking. You know, the materiality of the world, subjectively speaking and organizationally speaking, is really shrinking. The question is, what will we be doing with all of this? You know, and I feel that we will have two major vortexes. One is the good people trying to survive, so to say, and the other one is these very powerful actors that will include certain parts of national states, especially the executive branch, and they will go in a bit in the opposite direction. That is a very negative perspective. But I think that there is basically, we are not going to go back to the Keynesian period when you had closed national states, and it was very good for the middle classes. It was good for middle-sized firms. You know, we can't go back to that. We have lost that. And the question is, what kinds of struggles are we willing to engage in order to get out of this? This is a very negative set of conditions for the environment, for most people who are getting sort of poorer, and in a way for the sustainability of the earth. So it couldn't be worse in a way.
Our guest, Saskia Sausson, is a professor of sociology at Columbia University. She's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk dealing with some of these same issues this afternoon at 2 at the Graduate School of Library and Information Science. Her visit here is sponsored by the folks in sociology and also the European Union Center. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. Such great questions.